If you think 40 million readers can't be wrong, think again. On Monday, Publishers Weekly named 50 Shades of Grey author E.L. James as the magazine's Person of the Year. That award was not an award for the book, though it surely sounded like that to many critics who have lambasted PW for the choice. And in the week's review of reviews, Rose Fox finds Touch and Go, a thriller set in Boston with a plot seemingly stolen from the city's tabloid. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of news that everyone in publishing will talk about. Joining me from the offices of Publishers Weekly is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's senior writer. Welcome back, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So listen, you touched a nerve. We were sort of teasing people last time about the award coming out. It came out this Monday. You named, or Publishers Weekly at least, named E.L. James, the author of 50 Shades of Grey, as the person of the year in publishing. And what happened next?
Yeah, so I'm sorry I had to leave you guys hanging last week, but indeed the news is out. The brain trusted PW did choose E.L. James as our publishing person of the year, and I think it's safe to say the reaction has been rather strong. Now, far be it for me to deny anyone on the internet a chance to express an opinion. And all I really want to say in defense of our choice is that the honor is not a book award. That seems to be the main misperception driving, well, some pretty strong criticism of our choice, shall we say. But you know, no one at PW is telling you that you can't hate 50 Shades of Grey if you want to, or that you can't think that E.L. James is destroying our literary culture suddenly for some reason. But you know, our choice of E.L. James was not meant as some kind of literary betrayal, though some readers on our site seem to be very personally offended that we would choose E.L. James, to which I say again, it's not a book award. So if it's not a book award, then what is our person of the year? Well, mainly it's a selection of a person that we think has made the biggest impact on the field we cover, whether that's positive or negative. And I say positive or negative because that's why the Department of Justice, for example, got an honorable mention. Very few people would see that as a positive development, though some consumers might ultimately see that. But we chose E.L. James because, you know, as you well know, Chris, she came to publish the 50 Shades of Grey books through untraditional means, essentially self-publishing and fan fiction. And her success has inspired a new generation of authors and definitely has influenced and will continue to influence the way publishers now look for new writers. Now, again, you can argue about the book's merits. You can hate the book all you want. But, you know, the first soldier to hit the beach usually takes a bullet. And what we at PW want to look at is the wave of writers who are now pouring in behind E.L. James and their potential to really shake up literature. So you may not like E.L. James, but I promise you this. You are going to love an author one day in the future that you probably never would have found if not for E.L. James. Now, at the same time, E.L. James, her story is definitely worth a deeper dive. And if you haven't read Rachel Diehl's piece about the person of the year, you can go on the PW site and check it out. And while you're there, you can read the comments and maybe even add your own. But Rachel found E.L. James to be a very warm, humble, and very humble about her success, totally unpretentious. And this is a woman who has sold more books than just about any author in the history of the world. You know, that alone could make her person of the year. And, you know, one final note about all this, if you're a fan of Ron Charles at the Washington Post and his really terrific video reviews, he has a fantastic one that's kind of skewering our choice of E.L. James. And we link to that on the PWXYZ blog. So you can go there and find it and link to it. It really is hilarious. Ron, this is not a book award, and I think he totally misses the point in his video. But really, it doesn't matter. The video is hilarious and typically clever, and it gives Mr. Charles a chance to say some things that really do make a lot of sense. And we at PW, besides, are happy to have debate and discussion about the choice. But for us, it was a pretty easy call, and the more we thought about it, you know, if we look back at 2012, and we have to pick one person that made the biggest impact on the University of Publishing, it's E.L. James. and I'll just say one more time, it's not a book award.
Well, you could say it again if you feel like it. If it will make
it's not
you
a book
feel,
award,
if it'll make you feel better, Andrew. And listen, this may make you feel better. Just after you at PW called her the Person of the Year in Publishing, in the UK, where she is, of course, from, the National Book Awards gave 50 Shades of Grey its top prize for popular fiction. And in a report on that award by The Guardian, it quotes the prize organizers. They say the award recognizes the massive impact 50 Shades of Grey has made this year. The blockbusting title undoubtedly whipped up quite a stir from the publishing industry, media, and consumers alike. So if it helps, there's some,
there's some people
across the pond.
It really wasn't a hard call, so I'm glad somebody else out there
I don't
that.
Think it was a hard call at all, and a good call indeed. So definitely E.L. James has made a big impact, and as the year winds down, looking at a few other stories that have made an impact in 2012, you briefly mentioned the Department of Justice. What else is going on there?
Yeah, so the DOJ settlement stuff continues this week. You know, we heard that Hachette has indeed confirmed that they are selling ebooks under new terms. As mandated by the Department of Justice settlement that allows retailers to discount ebook titles. So right now you're seeing all kinds of stories and a new little burst of coverage about what this discounting is going to mean and what effect it's going to have. And there's a lot of opinions, and we're keeping track of them on the PW website, and we'll have more on this in the coming weeks. But you know, my impression really is right now, not much. Or should I say, the discounting is not having much of a negative impact, and not on publishers and authors for sure. Now, remember, at least when it comes to their ebooks, I should say. Remember, if a retailer wants to discount an ebook under this settlement and undersell their competition, that's not going to affect the publisher's cut. Publishers are still selling for their dictated prices. The only real difference when it comes to ebooks now is that the retailer is free to discount off their end, and that's for the next 2 years. So, you know, with a lot of tablets and new devices and e-readers expected to fill a lot of stockings this holiday season, retailer discounted ebooks might actually help publishers have a very strong holiday season. On the other hand, what this means for your local indie bookstore, what this means for print book sales, what it might mean for Barnes & Noble versus Amazon, that's still up in the air. We're going to have to wait and see. And you can read some of these reports in the coming weeks on PW as we get some of the numbers in. But I think it all goes back to a key point here with the DOJ settlement, and that's in terms of the bottom line. Forcing a handful of publishers to scrap their agency deals is really not much of a punishment, and it's not really going to hurt them. Then again, that's really not the pain point in the DOJ settlement.
Well, you're using words like punishment and pain, so do we have to go back and talk about 50 Shades of Grey again? but really, for the business side of things, what is the pain point?
So in a word, the pain point in the DOJ settlement, I think, is in the compliance. That settlement is now in place, and the settling publishers suddenly have a lot of hoops to jump through. And in the coming weeks and months, we're going to try to find out how that's going. We're talking about, you know, mandated training sessions and logs of phone calls and conversations about ebooks and reviews of documents and potential visits from DOJ officials that we don't know that any of that's happened yet. So that's really the pain here, that all these publishers now have the DOJ up in their grill for the next couple of years. For booksellers, we don't know where the pain is going to be yet in all of this. So, you know, we'll hope that this doesn't hurt them, and we certainly hope it doesn't hurt them during the holiday season. But for a deal that was meant to punish colluding publishers, I don't see that happening in the short term.
Well, Publishers Weekly covers more than just the courts, and indeed you cover a particularly important aspect of American publishing, African-American publishing.
That's right. And then Monday, it's our annual look at African-American publishing, which is always a really popular piece. You know, we also have a fascinating item on Hearst, which is suddenly getting back into book publishing because it has a new franchise it wants to support. It's called 7 Years Younger. And also our Jessamine Chan on Monday has a report on the University Press Roundtable that took place in New York last week with some really great observations on where the University Press publishing community stands and where it's headed. All that's in Monday's issue. And you can check it out in the magazine or on the PW website.
And we'll also go and check out those comments about the Person of the Year just to see how hot everyone has gotten on that. Andrew Albanese, PW's senior writer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Charmerville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, we want to talk about the books in this week's reviews, but let's talk about radio. Publishers Weekly has its own radio show. A channel on Sirius XM is called Book Radio, and every Thursday at 3 p.m., you're going to be telling us about the books that PW Reviews and just is covering.
Yeah, the show is called Publishers Weekly Radio, and it's on Sirius XM's Book Radio channel, where they do a lot of audiobook broadcasts. They do interviews with authors, and they approached PW actually and said, you know, "We really like PW's work, and we would like you to do a PW radio show." And actually, I have you to thank for this, Chris. They listened to the podcast and said, "Hey, that Rose person, Leo, that would be a good person to have on the radio." So thank you very much for getting my voice out there. I didn't know I was auditioning until I got the part, but there it is. I'll be co-hosting the show with Mark Rotella, who's a senior editor here at PW. And Mark mostly handles nonfiction. He also does a lot of author interview stuff, and I mostly handle fiction, as you know, especially genre fiction. So we're in a really good place to talk about the whole market, and we're also having PW editors call in at various times with more information about their specific sections.
It's really exciting, Rose, to hear all about this. We look forward to tuning in and wish you great success. But now we've got to put you to work here for the Beyond the Book.
And that's fine with me.
All right. We need to hear about the week's reviews. Let's start with fiction, as we usually do.
Okay. In fiction, we have a Q&A with Dutch author Herman Koch. That's K-O-C-H. And we're choosing the most mellifluous pronunciation there. I don't actually know how he pronounces his name, but let's pretend. His new novel, The Dinner, is a gripping psychological thriller about a five-course restaurant meal that goes terribly awry. And when we asked him if he really believes in the extreme behavior exhibited by his characters, or if he was just questioning some normative values we might otherwise take for granted, he said, "I was trying to let extreme behavior look almost like normal, in the sense that we might question ourselves how extreme or violent we really are deep down inside. Even if we don't act according to this behavior, we might secretly fantasize that we would like to do so." In fiction reviews, Tracy Chevalier returns with The Last Runaway, a haunting new novel that delves into the difference between a theory of faith and its practice. When young Quaker Honor Bright's fiancé breaks off the relationship, Honor goes to America with her sister Grace, who is engaged to marry a young man from their hometown who followed his brother to Ohio. This is set in 1850, and there are a lot of dangers along the way, so Grace dies en route and Honor arrives in Ohio alone and unsure of her future. She soon draws the attention of two men, one a slave hunter and the other a local farmer. And the PW Review says that Honor's aching loneliness, overwhelming kindness, and stubborn convictions are beautifully rendered. Also in fiction, Above All Things is the confident debut novel from Tanis Rideout. It scales great heights of obsession and desire, relaying the true story of George Mallory's attempt to reach the summit of Mount Everest in 1924. The author's accomplished depiction of the harsh and beautiful Himalayan heights, the physical drain of the climb, the bitter, brutal cold, and thin, grudging air pushes the reader forward in a gripping adventure narrative, while Ruth's own longings and fears offer a counterpoint of a more settled but no less intensely sensual interior landscape.
Well, in mystery and thriller, we'll start out with a book set in Boston's Back Bay.
Yeah, you love these Boston books. I feel like I should put in more of them just for you. this is Touch and Go. It's a no-holds-barred thriller from Thriller Award winner Lisa Gardner, and it opens with the brutally efficient kidnapping of the Denbe family, father, mother, and 15-year-old daughter, from their Back Bay Boston townhouse. And Gardner effectively alternates between the physical and emotional disintegration of the captive family and the efforts of law enforcement officials to find them as they dig into the secrets of the family construction company, its key employees, and its finances. Roger Hobbs's strong debut, Ghost Man, puts an original spin on the familiar premise of a lone wolf crook trying to outwit the underworld's higher powers through sheer verve. And the protagonist, identified only by the alias Jack Delton, must find the survivor of a badly bungled armored car heist in 48 hours before an ink bomb hidden in the cache goes off. Hobbs's supremely confident storytelling, should leave readers eagerly anticipating his anti-hero's future felonies. And the Q&A in Mystery and Thriller is with Lachlan Smith, who's the author of the debut legal thriller Bear is Broken. And Smith observes, to be popular, Perry Mason had to be unrealistic, with the clients always innocent and the truth in easy reach. But that's not how life is.
Well, moving from those mysteries to science fiction, we've got a mashup of a fairy tale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of Americana in this week's SF section. We start with Six Guns Snow White by Catherine M. Valenti. This is a fascinating reworking of the familiar Snow White fairy tale, and she sets it in the harsh world of the Old West. So Snow White's father is not a king, but a white businessman, and her mother is a crow woman, a native woman who he abducts and rapes. And their daughter's name is actually a cruel joke, because Snow White is not and can never be white. So once she's free from her father and stepmother, Snow searches for meaning, identity, and a place to call home. And our reviewer says any attempt to derive a simple message from this work would be an injustice to the originality of the atmosphere, the complexity of the interplay of its elements, and the simple pleasure of savoring Valenti's exuberant writing. We also have a Q&A with Robert Jackson Bennett about his fourth novel, American Elsewhere, in which aliens living in a small town struggle to perfect the appearance of American human normalcy. And Bennett says, in a lot of ways, what they're doing is something we do every day. We want the perfect house and marriage and to live a quiet, happy life. But it's not something you can just set up and step into.
Well, several appealing titles there, but certainly Six Guns Snow White gets my nod for title of the week. In romance, we've got some mixed marriages.
Yes, we do. In Gina Lamb's The Geek Girl and the Scandalous Earl, a young woman in modern times with an addiction to online fantasy games is transported back in time to 1816, where she falls in love with a heartbroken earl who's about to marry a very suitable but very boring debutante. And naturally, hijinks ensue as they struggle to bridge the cultural gulf there between 1816 and 2012. And Lamb gives the ending a few nice twists, satisfying fans of both historical and contemporary romance. Also, Beverly Jenkins creates a gently idealized 1880s California in Destiny's Embrace, matching up Mariah, a young black woman who grew up in a loveless home, and Logan, the son of a black rancher who was raised with love by his Spanish elite stepmother. Mariah starts out as Logan's housekeeper, but as she discovers her temper and her spine, the differences of race and class become just a few bumps on the road to love. Our reviewer says that Jenkins draws a world where the main characters extend their family relationships generously beyond the ties of blood.
Well, Rose, you know, you have needled me a bit about my love for Boston, but I have gotten out from just that city. And indeed, in my days as a journalist, I did some traveling behind what they used to call the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. And that's where nonfiction takes us, a look at the afterlife of totalitarianism in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's the subtitle of Marcy Shore's The Taste of Ashes. In this book, Europe is populated with prostitutes and pimps, street urchins and skinheads, and the landscape is cold and gray, burnt to ashes and rebuilt in Stalinist architecture. The book begins and ends with the suicide of one of Shore's friends, and many of the characters who fill its pages are ghosts, refugees of time and ideology, unable to make peace with the capitalist theme park that replaced their homelands. So this is part memoir, part travelogue, and part philosophical treatise, and ultimately an examination of what it means to live in a society where history shapes identity. And East meets West, we also have Western Europe clawing its way out of the Dark Ages, just barely, in Paul Collins's hair-raising history, The Birth of the West, Rome, Germany, France, and the Creation of Europe in the 10th Century. Formerly a Catholic priest, Collins surveys the century or so after Charlemagne's empire collapsed into civil war and anarchy. This is a time when government was a protection racket run by petty warlords, Viking and Muslim raiders pillaged and slaughtered Europeans, and popes comported themselves like Roman gang leaders. Writing with supple prose and an eye for colorful detail and vivid characters, Collins shapes some of history's most appalling behavior into a lively narrative with a comprehensible storyline. Taking an even bigger look, a painful reckoning awaits an out-of-whack global economy, according to the Great Rebalancing, Trade, Conflict, and the Perilous Road Ahead for the World Economy, an insightful treatise on international economics. Peking University economist Michael Pettis, who wrote The Volatility Machine, offers a sweeping perspective that links trade, exchange rates, and cross-border capital flows to underlying domestic taxation, investment, and fiscal policies. And by focusing on automatic and almost Newtonian mechanisms of trade and finance, Pettis completely rejects the moralizing that pegs countries as either virtuous ants or improvident grasshoppers. He thinks excessive national thriftiness is at least as sinful as extravagant consumption. And his stimulating contrarian take on the present crisis will challenge dogma with clear thinking. Finally, a nonfiction. In Bernini, Art as Theater, Genevieve Warwick, an University of Edinburgh lecturer and editor of art history, forms a cogent analysis that locates a masterful sculptor, architect, playwright, and scenographer within a Baroque culture of performance and spectacle. As Warwick contends, Bernini's bewitching lifelike sculptures, which employed elements of painting and architecture, were informed by his work in theater during the 1600s, a culture moment when theater as a concept, festival rituals, social customs, and manners played an organic role in court and religious life. It is exclusively academic, but the book repays reader effort with compelling insights.
Well, some fascinating titles there in nonfiction. Rosen, for children's and young adults, what do we got?
In picture books, we have a review of the final book by Russell Hoban, who readers will probably best remember from the Francis the Badger books. It's illustrated by Quentin Blake, and the book is called Rosie's Magic Horse, no relation. And it's a wonderfully imaginative and offbeat adventure in which a girl's popsicle stick collection turns into a horse named Stickerino, and together they take a dream trip to steal pirate treasure in order to help pay her father's bills. Hoban's language is incredibly funny and clever throughout, and unlike Maurice Sendak's forthcoming final book, which is quite mournful, this is a real exuberant send-off. In children's nonfiction this week, we have a collection of sketches and drawings from Australian author and artist Sean Tan, who's best known in the U.S. for The Arrival. I don't know if you've seen The Arrival. It's just an extraordinary book. No words, only pictures about the immigrant experience. And here Tan gives readers a thoughtful and open window into his creative process while mulling over the spontaneous energy of sketches versus the polished, finished works they become. He also talks about his own influences and interests and other topics. We also have a YA memoir from Daniel Hernandez, who was an intern for U.S. Rep. Gabby Giffords when she was shot in 2011. Hernandez was widely praised for his actions during the shooting, and his memoir discusses both the shooting and his own upbringing, including his commitment to public service and the bullying he faced due to his size, sexuality, and ethnicity. And we also round up Valentine's Day books for children, from board books for the youngest kids to picture books that examine the origins of the holiday and its traditions.
And finally, the pick of the week, another title that just grabs you right away. Tell us what it is.
Our title for this one is, the title of this one is Give Me Everything You Have on Being Stalked. And we headlined it, You've Got Hate Mail. When novelist and poet James Lasden began receiving deranged anti-Semitic electronic correspondence from a former student, he entered a realm of stricken enchantment in which technology and the primitive mind converge with the paranoias peculiar to our own age. This is an insightful discursive memoir in which Lasden reflects on topics as diverse as the seductive power of literature and his father's work as an architect in Israel. This subtle, compassionate take on stalking is rife with thoughts and insights into the current cyberculture cult of anonymity, as well as the power, failure, and magic of writing.
Rose Fox, thank you so much for joining us this week, and we look forward to hearing you on Sirius XM Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. I'm really glad to be able to do this and the other show. It's a nice, diverse range of ways of being entertaining on the air.
That's wonderful. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For everyone at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.